Conspiracy Radio on the Liberty Radio Network. I'm Gardner Goldsmith, and I am very pleased to be here with you on a Sunday night. Real chilly here in lovely southern New Hampshire, but it's warming up. I mean, shoot, man, it might have even reached 28 today. That's Fahrenheit, not Celsius. If you want to reach me anytime, you can email me at libertyconspiracy@yahoo.com. As I mentioned, I'm also over on Twitter at Gard Goldsmith on Twitter. We have the Facebook page for Liberty Conspiracy and things like that, although I noticed there are fewer people on Facebook now, and it's not just the young whippersnappers either. I think adults are spending less time on Facebook after the initial blush, which actually makes it harder to promote things. So, you know, for example, I have my novella called Bite, and you know, you're trying to get the word out on Twitter and Facebook and things, and like, it's very difficult. But anyway, yeah, you can join us over there, and over at the Liberty Conspiracy Facebook page, you'll notice a video that I recently posted that it features Tom Woods and Bob Murphy, and it has to do with nullification. It is an idea that is growing. In fact, I've contacted someone from the 10th Amendment Center to talk about nullification of unconstitutional federal laws on a state level. It's not an anarchist concept, but it is a constitutional concept going all the way back to the Jefferson, and even Alexander Hamilton, and then the George Mason wrote about this. So it goes back to the so-called founding era. And what I want to do now is let you know that because of ideas like that, because of ideas like free markets, concepts like don't drone me, bro, and the ideas that you are supposed to be left alone and have privacy, which evidently a lot of the people on the so-called left don't get. They used to, but evidently now that Obama's in office, they don't seem to care. That's not all, but many. We now recognize that we are, as the psychedelic furs used to say, a danger, evidently. More of the pop media is talking about libertarianism and libertarians. So, since we are often being taken out of context, since it seems like we're seen as a threat to them, perhaps we ought to find out what they're saying. Okay, while we have the opportunity to do that, we want to mention to you that if you disagree with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can offer your opinions. Yeah, feel free to email me. I'll open up the Skype line in a little while to you. You can text message me or come on the air anytime you want. And tell me why we're wrong in our assessment of this attack. So let's find out if we are really dangerous. I want to turn right now, before we bring on our guest, to an audio clip from actually a couple years ago of Rachel Maddow. She was one of the very first. No, she really wasn't. But as far as the pop media goes, she was one of the first to really start slamming around libertarians and libertarian ideas. And I think it's because they're beginning to feel a little bit uneasy, especially in the neoconservative circles in the Republican Party. They felt uneasy about libertarians for a long time, which is one of the reasons why in New Hampshire they've tried to make it very difficult for libertarians to get on the ballot, because they know disgruntled former conservatives are now turning towards the libertarian side, much like Glenn Beck calls himself a libertarian, much like Alex Jones calls himself a libertarian. Let's hear about one facet of libertarianism that is often used now and misrepresented. It's a great facet of libertarian concepts. It's called nullification, and it is being misportrayed in a malignant light in order to make libertarianism and the concept of nullification look really bad. And guess what they're doing? Yes, they're using the term racism.
What is remarkable 150 years after the start of the Civil War is how right now, so many of the hallmarks of the Civil War and of the Confederacy are in political fashion again. Nullification, which helped steer South Carolina into its militant anti-U.S. stance. Nullification is now enjoying a remarkable renaissance. Nullification is what Republican legislators in states all across the country have been screaming in the face of the new health reform law passed by Democrats in Congress last year. Just within the last 2 months, Republicans in Idaho and in Montana moved through their own nullification legislation. It's not just anti-federal health reform legislation. It's legislation that says that federal law doesn't apply here in our state. But it's not just health reform. A conservative group called the 10th Amendment Center has been pushing a lot of the anti-health reform stuff. They put that in the context of nullification, and they're pushing for other kinds of nullification, too. They're also, for example, proposing nullification of things like food safety laws and gun laws. In the state of Georgia, for example, Republicans are pushing the Georgia Food Freedom Act. Food freedom? Yeah, it would exempt the state of Georgia from federal regulations on the safety of the food supply. In Arizona, the state Senate there approved a bill exempting products from interstate commerce laws if they are made and used within Arizona. West Virginia attempting to do something similar, nullifying federal regulations on guns, as long as those guns are made and used within West Virginia. Kentucky trying to nullify federal laws regarding environmental safety. They are trying to proclaim themselves a sanctuary from the Environmental Protection Agency. Your federal laws don't apply here, Yankees.
Okay, don't apply here, Yankees. Well, let's take the opportunity now to turn to our guests. And also, by the way, folks, mentioned that about a month and a half ago, we did a show about an article that was in, I believe it was the New York Times, and it was about how libertarians are the new communists. Now, she mentions conservatives, but these ideas are very libertarian ideas. So let's bring in our guest, none other than Stephen Smith, the man behind a terrific, terrific blog site that lasted for many years, none other than A Beginner's Guide to Freedom. And Stephen, it's great to have you back on the show, buddy. Really, really good. I have him on camera, everybody, so it's great. And he's out in California where it's a little bit warmer than it is in the 28-degree area here. Greetings, Stephen. Good to have you back, buddy.
Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm really, really pleased to have you on the show, and I'm doing well. And, folks, this segment of this program, these segments, are inspired by an email that Stephen sent a while ago and some communication Stephen and I had. And I wanted to bring this up as a way of sort of a general conversation, Stephen, as you know, to talk about things that I think I've been noticing. I think you've been noticing them, too. Not only is the term libertarian being used more often by some people who were probably formerly paleoconservatives or maybe neoconservatives who sort of open their eyes a little bit, but also it's being attacked. Libertarian ideas are being attacked now a great deal. And you supplied a lot of information, articles all over the place in an email to me, a lot of links where libertarian ideas and the term libertarianism is being attacked. Do you get this impression as well, that not only are we resonating with more people, but a lot of the people on the neoconservative and left wing sides are starting to go after us?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is actually, to me, it's a continuation of a trend you and I have been discussing for a couple of years now. I don't know if you remember or not, but a couple of years ago, we had a discussion here on the Liberty Conspiracy about Michael Sandel's book, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do?
Yes.
Which was his attempt at justifying communitarianism. And what was interesting back then was that most of his arguments for communitarianism were made explicitly in contrast to libertarianism, which indicated to me that he didn't really view mainstream conservatism as much of a philosophical opponent. But he did think libertarianism posed a serious challenge to his brand of, well, let's just call it warmed over Marxism, because that's about all it
all
is.
All right, hold that thought, because I know I brought you in just before we're going to our break. So, Stephen Smith, you'll be with us in the next segment?
Oh, yeah, I'll be here for
Excellent.
As long as you can stand me.
Excellent. We'll let you start right out of the gates. We'll return with Stephen Smith talking about libertarianism. Is it being attacked? This program about how dangerous the libertarian movement is. That's right. The Psychedelic Furs could have written a song about us. This song, of course, produced by Todd Rundgren on their third album. Then a lot of people say, oh, it was too poppy. I dig the album a lot. And Stephen Smith is our guest. Stephen Smith talking to us from the West Coast. Great blogger whom I know has influenced many, many people. Stephen, thanks again for coming back after the commercial breaks. Appreciate it, buddy.
Oh, my pleasure.
Absolutely. We're speaking via Skype. I've got Stephen on the camera. And Stephen, the question posed in that second segment of the show now and in the third segment was, does it seem like libertarian ideas are getting attacked more? I mean, this just seems like anecdotal evidence. I don't know if anyone's done a study. Maybe the Reason Foundation could do something like what the Media Research Center does and try to look up all the mentions of libertarianism in the pop media networks and some of the pop channels like Newsweek or whatever. But your opinion seems to be yes, and you referred to a conversation we had a while back where someone was writing about this. Why don't you bring that up again?
It's been a couple of years now. We'd had a discussion about a book that was written by a Harvard professor, political science, Michael Sandel, who wrote, the title of the book was Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? And it's a communitarian justification, basically. And he made his arguments almost exclusively in contrast to libertarianism, which indicated to me that progressives in general, and not exclusively, but progressives are starting to wake up to the idea that the real philosophical challenge does not come from mainstream conservatism or from the Republicans or for red state or from red states or what we call the right. It comes from libertarianism. And I think we've seen that in a number of different articles recently, particularly on places like Salon.com. Has had a number of pieces routinely attacking libertarianism.
Yes, you provided some great links to me on those. The question libertarians can't answer, sorry libertarians, you're still hypocrites. I mean, just a whole mm-hmm. slew of stuff from
right.
Salon.
And most of the arguments that I've seen, again, on Salon, on the New York Times, or from the likes of Rachel Maddow, also Ann Coulter, Chris Christie, Mike Huckabee,
yes.
they're not terribly good arguments.
No.
The typical approach, which I think we heard earlier in the clip from Rachel Maddow, and then in a recent piece from the New York Times about Rand Paul, is to use guilt by association rather than actual argumentation.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really attacking they're not making very good arguments against the core philosophy, but they are scared enough to want to drag it through the mud and try to stamp it out before it really starts taking hold.
I agree with you 100%, Stephen. And that seems to be the prevailing type of attack that we get, that guilt by association thing. And of course, we can always go down to the next level, because sometimes that is provided when people write about communitarianism and so on. And just to address that point that you brought up about the communitarianism, I remember when you and I had that conversation about that particular book. And why don't you mention the name of the book again?
It's Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do?
By
Dr. Michael Sandel.
Right, and I'll make sure I don't think of him as Sandusky. It's Sandel,
no.
And I'm sorry to bring that up. It's a really sad thing from what that guy seems to clearly did to so many people.
Yeah.
It's interesting, because one of the things that we often hear philosophically on that next stage argument, let's start with that and then go back to some of this broad brush stuff and guilt by association. But the deepest they seem to go is in this sort of almost verbal legerdemain, where they use the term communitarianism, and you brought it up as he did in his book, and I remember you and I spoke about that, without including the concept of voluntarism.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they seem to try to gloss over when they talk about this is it's as if there's a populist communitarianism that you can achieve through force.
Right.
And they overlook the force. It's as if everyone agrees and everyone should feel good about it. And this is one of the problems that I find with all of these arguments is Rachel Maddow in particular, there's this whole idea of a national identity or a national something that has sloughed off certain layers of its former lizard-like self and has emerged to be this wonderful great thing through the years. In other words, if you at all question any of the ideas of the government as that snake has emerged, then you are part of its reptilian background and you should have nothing to do with public discourse.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, where we tend to talk past each other in a large degree. I think they are incapable of making fundamental arguments against libertarianism because they can't comprehend the level at which we make our critique of the state. They start with, hey, we have this box that we call government. How do we use the box?
Right.
Do we do it this way or do we do it that way? Do we want to do government plan A or government plan B? That's the only discussion. Libertarians come in and we start saying, well, wait a minute. Let's think about the box first.
Right. Yes.
And
yes.
And that, it frankly just doesn't compute, I think, to a lot of, maybe even most of the people. Certainly the professional statists.
Yes.
It just does not, you know, and again, I'll put, it's not just Rachel Maddow, but, you know, Ann Coulter, Chris Christie, Mike Huckabee from the right, particularly Rick Santorum, you know, they really cannot in, or at least let me put it this way. I have not seen them engage at that kind of fundamental ethical, moral level that we tend to approach the thing for.
I think that use of the box is a great point. And Stephen, if I could just mix something into that, they don't even understand, or it's they don't seem to indicate an interest in wanting to discuss the idea that the box shouldn't be built, that if someone is going to do something, he should be able to do it himself. They believe that the box exists, and it itself is a good thing. As you say, it's just a matter of how the box is used. We say to ourselves, well, who built the box? Am I trapped within it? And I don't want to draw the analogy out too far, but it does seem as if this concept of everyone has come together and spoken seems to ride on both the left and the right and drives them against those of us who said, no, guess what? Even if you think everyone has spoken, what if they spoke and they don't even want to participate? What if they didn't speak and they don't want to participate? They don't allow for that sort of a thing. And I think that what's fascinating to me is this kernel of voluntarism is definitely overlooked. And even when you get it into the constitutional level, as we're starting to see now with the 10th Amendment Center and others, then they start to broad brush. Then they start to slam people around, because that itself is a functional thing that resonates with people, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's and I think when you start raising questions about the ethical justifications of that box, you start tapping into something very, I think, deep-seated about their own, their self-image or their self-worth, because they've bought into this idea that we are the government. You know,
yeah.
L'état, c'est nous, I guess.
Yes, 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 yes. It's turned from l'état, c'est moi, to l'état, c'est nous, right?
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yep, yep.
And when you start questioning that, then I think you really start... it comes across as an attack against something very deeply held in their identity,
right.
And that's when they start again, the statists of the left and right variety, that's when they start circling the wagons, and man, you've never seen them cooperate. As you talk about bipartisanship, they will be bipartisan to protect that box above everything, because they're very comfortable arguing with each other within that construct.
Absolutely.
But once you get out of it, then it's Katie bar the door, and you'll see the attacks from the right and the left in order to protect the idea of the construct of the state as it is.
This is good. We'll return. We have to go to commercials. We'll return with Stephen Smith in just a moment. We roll along at Liberty Conspiracy Radio on the Liberty Radio Network. Gardner Goldsmith here with you. Thanks very much for being in the audience, a fellow conspirator, perhaps. Okay, lots to discuss with our guest, Stephen Smith. Stephen is talking to us from the West Coast. Amazing volume of work that he created with his fantastic website, A Beginner's Guide to Freedom. Stephen, welcome back, my friend. Good to have you here, buddy, and it's good to see you. It's kind of weird seeing you from so long, far away through Skype and everything, but it's really great to see you, man.
You too. How you doing?
All right. Absolutely. And folks, I know the Beginner's Guide. I hope someday that you put all those articles out in a book or something. You know, make them all available on Amazon or something like that, because it would just they're terrific essays and really teach people a lot about freedom.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Talking about freedom, we've introduced a subject on the program, everybody, which is sort of an observational conversation about are libertarians and libertarian ideas starting to be attacked, either specifically libertarians or the libertarian ideas that have sort of risen up and gained some traction with maybe, you know, Tea Party folks or whatever, or some of the hosts who now identify themselves as libertarians. We played a piece from Rachel Maddow about the concept of nullification. We'll speak specifically to that and other arguments that are leveled against libertarianism and arguments leveled in favor of statism in the next hour. But, Stephen, you were just telling me, I asked Stephen during the break, folks, what he thinks might be attributable to this change, the greater recognition of libertarian ideas, the greater traction it seems to have with people, and the greater fear that some of the pop media statists have on the left and the right. Stephen, you were offering me something during the break that I thought was very valuable. So why don't you just roll with it, buddy?
Well, I mean, it's just my pet theory, but you asked why is it that maybe libertarianism is now more is gaining traction, perhaps? And I think, and this is just again my pet theory, but it could be that in the Bush years, the right or the conservative or at least open-minded conservatives saw the failure of the Republican Party to deliver on anything remotely resembling small government principles. Massive wars, massive spending, massive debt, et cetera, expansion of government in every possible way. And there was a lot of disenchantment on the right, according to the principles of the right.
Yes.
And now we have now we're in the whatever year of Obama, and I think we're seeing the same kind of disenchantment on the left according to the standards of the left. So he has failed in every way to protect civil liberties. He continues to wage the drug war. He's done nothing but expand American military adventurism abroad.
Yeah.
He's brought in some frightening expansions to the Bush policy, such as drone strikes on American people without any sort of due process whatsoever.
Yeah.
So again, the standards he has failed up to live up to the standards of the left. So it's been an interesting experiment these past however many years it's been. It seemed a lot longer.
Yeah, really, really.
But both the right and the left have failed by their own standards. And I think that's given people cause to go look for maybe other ideas. Say, okay, well, the philosophy that I thought I adhered to hasn't really delivered. Maybe I'll look around and see what else is out there. And I think libertarianism is filling that void for a lot of people these days.
I think you're right. And, I hearing what you have to say, Stephen, our guest is Stephen Smith, folks. If you're listening to us just right now, just tuning in, we're talking about libertarian ideas picking up traction and also starting to be targets for people on both sides on the pop media spectrum. But in many cases now, the left is really starting to go after a lot of the libertarian concepts, free markets, anti-spying, the drones, things like that, and the concept of decentralization of government, at least in the Hayekian worldview and economic view, and perhaps even further, attacking the Mises Institute, attacking people like Lou Rockwell, attacking Ron Paul when he was having some traction. I think it's interesting because there have been some left-wing folks who have, like John Cusack, who have said honestly, you know what, I cannot... in order to keep up with my belief in socialized Medicare and things like that, I cannot overlook the awful things that he is doing, Obama is doing in his administration to crush civil liberties and kill people overseas. And I think that is outstanding, but it's so rare. Instead, it seems like you get this circling of the wagons like Rachel Maddow is doing. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that if they were to have, say, Jim Crow laws, or if they were to have, say, the fugitive slave law on the books nowadays, Rachel Maddow would be the first person to say, don't abide by that law. There were states at the time that talked about nullifying those laws. And I never instead, they try to claim that things like nullification, I don't want to go too specifically into this, but they try to claim that things like nullification are somehow vestiges of a racist past in the United States, that it's that awful reptilian skin that has been shed and should never come back, you know? Do you think, Stephen, that in the Republican Party, you know, folks who have always been sort of the rhino milquetoast type people, they've always been, I think, very aware, or they've become more aware in the various states as libertarian ideas have gained traction. And here in New Hampshire, I know that they have actually passed legislation to raise the standards to have to for people to be able to get onto a ballot, because they don't want libertarians to get on the ballot. They think they'll draw away from Republicans. Do you think that Republicans themselves are starting to feel very nervous when they see some of these libertarian ideas pop into their mainstream?
Yeah, I think they are. Well, and again, I don't want to broad brush them in the way that we get broad brushed.
Sure.
I have seen a division. And so, for example, and please don't take anything about any of the people that I'm about to bring up as an endorsement of those people. But for example, I was listening to Sean Hannity the other day. Now, Sean Hannity is fairly friendly to Rand Paul, and Rand Paul's, if you want to call him a libertarian, that's questionable, but Hannity's very friendly to Rand Paul and libertarians in general. He recognizes that libertarians historically have been aligned with the Republican Party, and he recognizes, I think, from a demographic perspective, that if the GOP wants to win anything, they need that group in their tent. Whether or not they can get them back in their tent, I don't know. I have my doubts. But he was having a discussion with Ann Coulter, again, another professional statist from the right, and you know, she dismissed libertarianism. She says, "Well, you know, eventually libertarians turn 19 and stop smoking pot." And that was her argument.
They do that to their detriment. And I think part of the reason why people like Hannity and Ann Coulter and others, especially Hannity, people within the Republican Party have got to start recognizing that the old groups to which they used to turn, the old anti-communist groups that would go along to get along to keep the Republican Party in charge, there is a new group of people who are much more libertarian, and they are not willing to sell out their principles in one way or another just to win in office. They're just not willing to do it. And I think this is an extremely important point that you brought up, as that change, as the, you know, as the Bush administration 1 and Bush administration 2 came along and more Republicans became disenchanted, they are leaving them behind. And they're not going to go back. And I think especially when they see a guy like Ron Paul, who's so consistent, and the stuff that he says in Republican primaries is proven correct, they're starting to say to themselves, maybe a lot of them are saying, I don't want to deal with that stuffy group of GOP blowhards anymore.
Well, particularly the way that whole campaign went. I mean, if you look back to the last election cycle, you saw the fracturing of the GOP happening on national television, because you had, I think, the three different wings of the Republican Party on display with three different candidates, with Mitt Romney representing sort of the technocrat country club Republican who really had no allegiance to any sort of political philosophy. They just thought, well, we can manage this organization better than anybody else. Then you had the social conservatives, the religious right, represented by, I think, best by Rick Santorum, who were all about using government to mold the United States into some sort of social format that they adhere to for whatever reason, whether it's some sort of a nostalgic kind of idea about what life used to be like here. And then you had the libertarian wing represented by Ron Paul.
All right, hold that thought. We'll just hold on to that. You know, we have our top of the hour news break. We'll come back. I want to talk to Stephen Smith a little bit more about this. And Stephen, by the way, we can even chat a little bit during some of the breaks. I'm going to keep this in the podcast. I want to implore you to take, if you still have those Beginner's Guide to Freedom blog posts, and you could turn them into something. You would have a humdinger of a book that you could sell, you know, or offer free to people or whatever. It's just, I don't know how many pages worth of material you wrote, but that is...
I was going through them the other day. I mean, I do have the original posts.
Yeah.
I don't have... I don't know if you have seen the site?
No, wait. Cool. When you told me, I went over there, when you told me that you would stop doing it.
Yeah, somebody has taken over the domain name.
Yes.
And it's now an Indonesian... it's an advertisement for an Indonesian male enhancement drug. So there you go.
Funny. You know what's so funny is we used to. Sorry to distract, but when I used to bring Mick on as John Taylor, the supposed expert, and we would do those skits where he would tell us some things, and then eventually, what he would say would start to go off the rails a little bit, and you realize he's a complete fraud, you know. And he would always go as John Taylor, who's the guitarist for Duran Duran.
Yeah.
And he would give the website. I was like, what's the website for the Taylor Institute? And he goes, and he would go pinkflag.com, which is the website for the band Wire.
Okay.
So they would go to, you know, anybody listening on the radio show live on WGIR, they, you know, in Manchester, they go to pinkflag.com and it'd be this punk band Wire.
And yeah, it's like, you know, basically another version, like Rickrolling them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh man!
But yeah, no, I've still got the original post, and it's. I mean, if you put them together, it's a couple hundred pages, but they're not all. You know, a lot of them were. First off, I didn't start liking my own writing until about midway or three quarters of the way through.
Interesting.
And you know, there are a couple that I still, you know, that still hold up. A lot of them were, you know, about something that I saw in the paper that day. And
yeah,
it
so it's a
really,
timely sort of thing.
Exactly,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, I get the sort of, same sort of thing. A lot of folks are telling me, oh, you know, you should turn Live Free or Die into an ebook and so on. I was like, yeah, but, you know, a lot of those articles are dated. You know, the book came out in 2007. Great. Yeah. You know, and it's funny. I don't even have the original text for the original articles all. Yeah.
You don't have electronic?
Yeah, the electronic version of it that I put together actually is on a hard drive that crashed.
Yeah.
And I wasn't able to save it. We couldn't even do a forensic. Well, I could give it to a forensic guy. He might be able to pull the stuff off. I could turn them. I suppose it wouldn't hurt to turn it into an ebook anyway, and people would just read it. And, you know, I mean, they still read articles by Albert J. Nock, you know, so why not, you know, so. I might do it. I think it costs like $75 to have the Amazon people turn it into a Kindle book for you.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, it could be kind of good. Yeah. So anyway, well, look, hold on just a minute. Podcast audience, I'm going to leave that in there for the podcast audience. We continue at Liberty Conspiracy Radio on the Liberty Radio Network. Gardner Goldsmith here with you, along with my guest, speaking to me from, well, our guest, everybody's guest. Stephen Smith is with us. He is the guy who created A Beginner's Guide to Freedom, which is was a terrific blog site with some amazing pieces about freedom, drawing out things that had happened just at the time, and then taking, as we often try to do there here in this program, taking those stories in the news and then unraveling them and creating a better understanding of freedom, free markets, and the libertarian principles. Stephen, thank you for coming back. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's really great. And thanks on the positive words and what we were talking about before. I didn't get to mention that to you because we were coming back, but I really appreciate the fact that you liked. Well, we're talking about the novella, everybody, so thank you. I'm glad you liked it. That's really
great. Buy the novella. Buy it.
I know. I need to get more sales so I can make like $100 off it, you know. But, yeah, it's not even in paperback form in the U.S. yet, but it should be very soon, and we'll get the Nook version will be out soon. But the Kindle is available now, and the paperback is available from Wales, from pendragonpress.net. So, Stephen, we were, before the top of the hour news break, we were talking in the last hour about libertarian ideas, whether they seem to be getting more traction with people. I think Ron Paul was really instrumental in getting a lot of younger people involved with that. There tends to be an anti-big X, Y, or Z sentiment among young people. I think it's often misplaced, and it's anti-successful business because they think that somehow the business has somehow exploited its laborers and consumers and things like that. And there tends to be a lack of understanding that the corporate state, the corporations that many of the 9%ers don't like, have often gained their places or have often helped game the system through political means, not through market means. And so trying to explain to people that markets tend to insulate people from bad guys, tend to cause the competitive marketplace to actually make people compete for the consumer dollar, not take advantage of the consumer, to actually help the consumer. It's a difficult sell sometimes for the younger guys. But I do think that, just to sort of, you know, go back to what you were discussing about libertarian ideas and how we were talking about libertarianism sort of picking up steam with people, I do think there are ways, and I think Ron Paul did a great job doing it. I think Peter Schiff has done a pretty good job. There are many ways to get younger people to not only dislike spying and not only dislike drones and things like that, but also to get them to understand that decentralization is better, that big government tends to be very difficult to control. You're not going to get much response from it. And it seems to me that those libertarian ideas are really picking up. And as we said, they're getting assaulted by a lot of people on the left state and the right state side. Any other thoughts that you wanted to add to that, Stephen?
Yeah, I think it is important that people do understand those kinds of distinctions, because when people react to the world around them without understanding cause and effect, they tend to come up with really bad ideas as to how to remedy those injustices. Mm. And in fact, the Rolling Stone magazine had an article from January 3rd where they outlined some really bad ideas to address those perceived economic injustices, and it's titled Five Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For, and they're all really, really bad ideas. Now, I did note that the story was published on January 3rd by Jesse A. Meyerson. So, first and foremost, I think Rolling Stone is in the early lead for dumbest article of 2014. But seeing that it was January 3rd, maybe the guy was still hungover from his New Year's Eve celebrations. I'm not sure. But if you look at the article, it's his great ideas are guaranteed work for everybody, Social Security for all, take back the land, make everything owned by everybody, and a public bank in every state. So that's his cutting edge ideas to improve the economy.
Well, shall we start to investigate some of these things? And we'll just, I think it's important for us to mention that, we can recognize that many of these things are parts of the Communist Manifesto just reworded.
Right.
What's funny about this is that the Communist Manifesto, pretty much every plank has been already implemented in the United States. Yeah. Everything from Social Security, progressive taxation, government-run health care, and government schooling.
Central bank,
exactly. And I think it's also interesting, folks, you can see a really neat reply to this. We were talking about this earlier. Steve and I were talking about it. Glenn Jacobs wrote for the Daily Caller about none other than Jesse Meyerson. And he says, Rolling Stone's Jesse Meyerson was roundly ridiculed last week when he wrote that the solution to America's economic ills was to embrace communism. Meyerson, who promotes the Twitter hashtag full communism on his bio, never uses the term communism in his op-ed, but communism by any other name still smells the same, like human misery, poverty, and death. Very well stated. And these types of ideas that Meyerson pushes in his Rolling Stone piece, I think, are extremely dangerous, because we're seeing portions of these types of things already, and people don't understand that the principles themselves are bad, 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 bad. Shall we talk a little bit about some of these things, Stephen, and go through some of the arguments?
Sure.
All right. Well, I'll just read a real quick one. All right. I'll just read the first one here. You mentioned guaranteed work for everybody. He says, unemployment blows. The easiest and most direct solution is for the government to guarantee that everyone who wants to contribute productively to society is able to earn a decent living in the public sector. There are millions of people who want to work, and there's tons of work that needs doing. It's a no-brainer, and this idea isn't as radical as it might sound. It's similar to what the Federal Works Projects Administration made possible during Roosevelt's New Deal, and Dr. Martin Luther King vocally supported a public sector job guarantee in the 1960s. Would you like to offer some thoughts on that, Stephen Smith?
Well, it is no-brainer, but not in the way I think he intends. Again, this, all of these kind of statist fantasies always tend to overlook the fundamental question is, where does the money come from?
Right.
His idea is just, however many people are out of work, just give them a government job. Well, those government jobs can only pay money from two sources, really.
Mm-hmm.
You can either increase the taxes on the decreasing proportion of the populace who's still working in the private sector,
mm-hmm.
Or you can just print money and hand it out to people, and that is the way you get to be a Zimbabwe.
Yes, and I should say maybe there's a 0.5 there, which is you can borrow the money and create, have another entity like the Federal Reserve created out of thin air, and then have to pay back that money with either more borrowed money or higher taxes.
Right, it's just foisting that cost onto the productive sector, but doing it a generation or two down the road.
Absolutely right. And isn't it an interesting, Stephen, how they don't want to address this point? They don't want to discuss that, or at least, you know, it seems very obvious to me that the left-wingers aren't really going into, well, where does this come from, you know? Well, let's go to the next one. Why don't you read that next one to us?
Social Security for all. But let's think even bigger. Because as much as unemployment blows, so do jobs. What if people didn't have to work to survive? Enter the jaw-droppingly simple idea of universal basic income, in which the government would just add a sum sufficient for subsistence to everyone's bank account every month. A proposal along these lines has been gaining traction in Switzerland, and it's starting to get a lot of attention here, too.
Okay. Well, would you like to comment on that, my friend?
Yeah. You know, incentives matter, and the incentive to work is kind of important. That's what has increased our standard of living, is that people go into work in the productive sector in order to create goods and services that other people desire. And that's how wealth is created. I make something, I trade it to you for something that I value more. You trade me something because you value what I'm giving you more.
Hold that thought. We've got commercials. We'll be back. Stephen Smith will return. We continue at Liberty Conspiracy Radio on the Liberty Radio Network with our guest, Stephen Smith, who's talking to us from California. Just talking a little bit right now about some of the very strong left-wing ideology that is starting to rise up, not just attacking libertarianism, but from perhaps the Occupy movement and things like that, going beyond even Obamacare, which hopefully we libertarians can address. Stephen mentioned that he found an article on Rolling Stone's website that he would nominate as one of the potential big award winners for dumbest article of the year so far, something put out by Jesse Meyerson on January 3rd. And it's five economic reforms for which, well, actually, he didn't even write it this way, reforms millennials should be fighting for. So, you know, here's a nationally published article with the dangling preposition. Stephen, we were on bit number two, Social Security for All, and you were talking about how free market exchange from one person to another, one person giving up something that he values for something he values more, and the other person doing the same, leads to greater standards of living. And things like Social Security tend to retard the incentive to work, correct?
Right. Yeah, and generally speaking, people... human beings prefer leisure to work. You know, that's the way it is. And it's generally understood that if you tax something, you get less of it. And if you subsidize something, you get more of it. So what he's talking about is we should subsidize less work, which would imply that you would get more people not working because of the general preference to for leisure to work. And so it makes you wonder where that ends. And it ends in the same place that the first item ends, which is basically just printing up funny money and handing it out to people.
Yes, yes. Mr. Meyerson says here that enter the jaw, as Stephen wrote, enter the jaw-droppingly simple idea of a universal basic income in which the government would just add a sum sufficient for subsistence to everyone's bank account every month. And, of course, as you said, it only can come from certain places. Either it comes from the people who are actually producing things that consumers want and are paying for. It either comes from them through taxes, or it comes through borrowing, or the printing of money, or the printing of money to pay for the borrowing down the line. Then, of course, we've got number three in Mr. Meyerson's planks, take back the land.
Ever noticed how much landlords blow? They don't really do anything to earn their money. They just claim ownership of buildings and charge people who actually work for a living the majority of our incomes for the privilege of staying in boxes that these owners often don't build and rarely, if ever, improve. In a few years, my landlord will probably sell my building to another landlord and make off with the appreciated value of the land he claims to own, which won't even get taxed as long as he plows it right back into more real estate. Think about how stupid that is. The value of the land has nothing to do with my idle remote landlord. It reflects the nearby parks and subways and shops, which I have access to thanks to the community and public. So why don't the community and public derive the value and put it toward uses that benefit everyone? Because capitalism is why. Okay. You know, some of these are just, again, it's kind of hard to take this seriously, except for the fact that it's Rolling Stone is not, it's not exactly the little neighborhood daily or weekly. It's not the Penny Saver, right? I mean, it's a nationally, an internationally sold magazine.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing that this article managed to get through even their relatively loose editorial standards. But obviously, you know, the landlord provides a service. He takes capital and he invests it in a piece of real estate in the assumption that he is going to be able to derive an income stream for it. But what that enables people to do is have a place to live without having to go out and earn that degree of capital on their own and employ it in that particular way.
Yes.
So it frees them up to do other things that they may be more interested in or be more talented at than real estate. But the idea that somebody creating a building for people to live in is not a legitimate service is just it's too ridiculous to even contradict.
It definitely ruffles my feathers so much, you know, and what gets me is, for example, my niece is in the play Rent this year, and, you know, the guy who owns the building is the bad guy, you know, he's the bad guy amongst many bad guys. So they say, how are we going to pay the rent? We're not going to pay the rent. You know, we're not going to pay next year's rent. You know, this stuff. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. But what gets me is I say, so how about the landlord says, how am I going to pay my land taxes, my utility bill, you know, all the other things that he provides to these people that they don't want to pay for? You know,
and it
speaks so much to the what is seen and what is not seen concept that it's so endemic to left wing thinking that they can just look at it. Well, this is just a place to stay. And so the person who owns this place to stay, he's taking advantage of me. It's like, no, he's providing you something of value. This is something that you are using, and he has to supply certain things to keep that going, and he needs to get an income to pay somebody else for the stuff that he needs.
Right. And there's this underlying concept, again, in this kind of mentality that wealth exists independent of its creation.
Yes, right.
And that no matter what it's just a question of how do we divide it up. And it's again, it's the old story of the goose that laid the golden egg. You know, leftists read the goose that laid the golden egg, and they think that the moral of the story is don't be greedy.
Yeah.
Well, the moral of the story is not don't be greedy. The moral of the story is you cannot kill the engine of production and expect wealth to continue to be produced.
Right. That's exactly it.
But that's sadly, that lesson has to be learned over and over and over again, evidently.
Absolutely. And here we have the fourth one, make everything owned by everybody.
Yeah, so this is basically, and I don't want to necessarily read everything, but this idea is basically, let's take the tragedy of the commons and make everything the commons. You know, the best way to deplete capital stock is to have it owned in common, which means really not owned at all.
Right.
Because that incentivizes people to utilize the resource excessively until it's completely destroyed.
Exactly. Best way to yes.
And he wants to take that and make it a national policy.
And of course, one of the major problems behind that is if you are going to make everything owned by everybody, how do you divvy it up? And that becomes impossible unless you've got a price mechanism based on people's own valuations, because their valuations are different.
Right. And then it becomes purely a political process, which means it's a might makes right,
right
process.
Yes.
I get stuff because I'm a friend of somebody who has power, or I have power myself, and I can just take it.
Yes. Yes.
That way.
Yes.
As opposed to earning it on the free market through voluntary exchange.
Absolutely.
By offering something of value to somebody in exchange for something else of value.
And I just want to stress again that if a business person or a company that he forms begins to grow in a free market, it is because he is serving more and more people. It's because they recognize what he's doing as good to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't give up what they had for what that other person had. So the largeness does not connote to evil. It actually connotes to having helped more people. And it also doesn't mean that someone's going to be taken advantage of because that person's big. Oh, you know what, Stephen? We have to take a break.
Okay.
Hold that thought. I know you got something to say. And then we'll finish off with this and some other ideas. Return.
Okay.
So, nice. Yeah, it's pretty all right, cool. We're back, Liberty Conspiracy Radio on the Liberty Radio Network. Yeah. All right. Let's continue our conversation with Stephen Smith. We're going through something right now, which is, I think, a very, very good contender for dumbest article of the year. Stephen is the man who brought this to my attention. It's by Jesse, what's his name?
Meyerson,
and it's for Rolling Stone. Stephen, thanks very much for coming back. It's called Five Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For. One maybe would be grammatical reform to eliminate prepositions at the end of the sentences. But we were on the very thrilling, we just finished with number four, make everything owned by everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, did we get on number four? Yeah, so we were talking about number three was take back the land. Oh, number four is make everything owned by everybody. That's the next one. So do we want to, you want me to read some of this, or you want to read it? What do you think, my friend?
Well, I think we covered that one. The one thing you were making before we took out on the break, you made the point that in a free market, the size of a company is not necessarily indicative that it's doing anything wrong. In fact, it's indicative of that they're doing something right.
Yes.
That they've grown, they've earned market share because they have been able to please more and more customers in an efficient manner.
Yes.
And I think it's important to note that that would be true in a free market.
Yes.
But it's important to note that when we say that, we are not referring to the current economic system that we are living within.
Absolutely.
So today, and I think one of the things that maybe the Occupy crowd has at least a sense of is that in today's sort of crony capitalist system, a lot of times size of a corporation does imply that they have achieved that size through illicit means, which for us would be through aligning itself with state power in order to obtain an advantage over competitors, to create barriers to entry that they would not be able to do without the state.
That's very, very well said, Stephen. Absolutely right. And I think something that comes to mind is that the Occupy movement, as you say, they have a sense of this, and one of the ways that this functions is not only that, of course, corporations can get favors from government to impose tariffs on products coming in from overseas, or to get bailouts or special research grants and, you know, things like that. But in addition to that, there is there's this general antipathy towards some of the CEOs of large corporations getting big bundles mm-hmm. of money.
Yep.
And I mentioned to my niece that, you know, I don't mind a CEO getting a big bundle of money if, you know, if I'm in a free market system, because he is getting paid. We don't know how many jobs that person might have helped start by making the company more profitable and allowing for its expansion. But when you have a crony corporate capitalist system, the big corporations, the big banks and so on, they're the ones that get the money from the expansion of the money supply before mm-hmm. everybody else does.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why the stock market is so inflamed right now, and there's still double-digit unemployment for average people out there, because you've got big corporations getting a lot of money, and the people with their jobs being established, they're dipping in and they're grabbing a lot of that cash. And what you see is the people at the beginning of that train get that cash, and I can definitely understand where that criticism is appropriately placed if they could understand, as you say, the political influence that is involved with the monetary system and the corporation system. I think that's really key. All right, want to hit the last one there?
Yeah, and the last one is a public bank in every state.
Oh, great.
Yeah. The whole point of a finance sector is supposed to be collecting the surplus that the whole economy has worked to produce and channeling that surplus wealth towards its most socially valuable uses. It is difficult to overstate how completely awful our finance sector has been at accomplishing that basic goal. Let's try to change that by allowing state governments into the banking game.
Okay.
Okay, a lot to unpack with that.
Yeah.
But again, as soon as you have government enter into any element of the economy, then the last thing that happens is wealth being directed to socially valuable uses. At that point, wealth gets redirected to politically valuable uses.
Exactly.
And I think the experience of the Fed is pretty clear on that case, and I don't think that establishing 50 more little Feds would necessarily make things better.
This I think is a concept that's endemic, goes all the way back to Rousseau, all the way back to Socrates and Plato, but was really quite firm within Rousseau's concept of the general will and Marx's Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital itself. These ideas that somehow you could have the general will through the assembly, through the representative government, as opposed to the, what did he call it, the common will, which was individuals deciding for themselves. To find out what is socially valuable, you've got to let society, the members of society, decide. And society is separate from government. So the only way you can do that is to allow individuals to decide what is valuable to them, which harkens us back to subjective marginal utility theory, the subjectivity of individuals in the marketplace deciding for themselves, and then that key factor, the price mechanism. Once they decide what is valuable to them, others can see that, and then they can move based on what tends to be most valuable to the most people. And in all these different fields, in agriculture, business, entertainment, things start to rise to the fore. And this is one of the things that Marxism couldn't answer, which was, how are you going to show what is socially valuable unless you have a market? If you're having these political decisions being made, then you're undercutting all of those social decisions, right?
Right, and that was Mises's critique of the socialist calculation.
Yeah.
And again, inherent in this line of thought, and I use air quotes around thought, is that there is outside, there is some sort of objective good, yeah, as you were referring to,
yeah,
that can be known by some small group of people. And that small group of people can make better decisions than the millions or billions of people freely operating in the market economy, and it's just a ridiculous concept. There is simply no way that a small group of people can hope to match the cumulative knowledge that exists within the market. And then, as soon as you take out, as you mentioned, as soon as you take price out of the picture, then it becomes even. It just completely unworkable, and it's nonsensical. And I think But I think one of the things that is important about this article is the headline, Five Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For. Now, he's targeting this to people who are too young to remember the Cold War.
Oh, right.
Or the second half of the 20th century, the big drama that we had between, let's say, more free countries and totalitarian command and control type countries. Mm-hmm. And all of these lessons, and again, the guy uses the hashtag on Twitter, full communism. So we know where he's coming from. But that that experiment was tested, and the results were pretty darn clear. But he's targeting people who don't remember what it was like and don't remember that side-by-side comparison of relatively free markets against totalitarian command and control markets, like the kind that he's trying to argue we should implement. And I think, as Glenn referenced in his article, the results of the totalitarian market, that those totalitarian economic controls don't stop there. They wind up in mass deprivation and death.
Yeah,
that is the lesson of these kinds of centrally planned economies, and it's certainly nothing that we should be emulating here.
No, Stephen Smith is our guest, folks, and okay, I know we have to say thumbs up to the people who sponsor us on Liberty Radio Network. We're heading, I can hear the music heading towards commercials. You know, it's interesting, Stephen, we've begun the program talking about how libertarian ideas are being criticized, generally speaking, and we have some examples of the left wing and what they're promoting. Let's go back a little bit and talk about a couple issues they're attacking libertarians and using against us. We'll return.
Sure.
Okay, so what I'd love to do is talk a little bit more about this nullification thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a good piece from Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. I can read a little bit, and then I can always add to that later with reference to the podcast. And also, as you mentioned, that list of articles, whether it be Grow Up Libertarians,
mm-hmm.
or 11 Questions to See if Libertarians Are Hypocrites, libertarians are still hypocrites. One of the things that I think is really important is they often try to ask us to give them examples of, they often,
you know, the left wingers will often say, well, there are a couple things. First, they'll say, well, you can't provide us with any examples
mm-hmm.
in history.
Yeah.
And so, for example, who was it who wrote this piece?
Michael Lind.
Yes. He said, yeah. Well, you know, so-and-so said Ronald Bailey cites the spread of particular liberties such as since the 18th century as evidence that the entire world is becoming libertarian. But he ignores the fact that the welfare state and business regulation have grown up together with democracy and civil liberties. Now, yeah. he makes a good point. You know, Ronald Bailey should have expanded on that and shown the causative, not just correlative, association between greater yeah. freedom and greater economic growth.
But Bailey's piece was a response to Michael Lind's first piece. So Michael Lind started it.
Yes.
Bailey responded.
Right.
And then Michael Lind responded to the response.
Yes, yes.
And I actually wrote a piece, which I was off air. I was offline by then.
Oh, wow.
But I saw that one, and I just could not resist it. So I wrote something. It's unpublished.
Oh, man.
But I took my shot at Michael Lind as well.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
We
can talk just briefly about the nullification stuff again,
yeah,
and then go into this larger thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because Michael Lind is a good example. He's Salon's kind of designated libertarian hitman.
Yes.
Or hitman against them whenever they want a piece.
Yes, yes.
Against, they drag him out, and they know that they're going to get a gazillion hits because of it, because all the libertarian blogosphere is just going to like go nuts on Michael Lind. And it's kind of like, you know, I don't care what they say about me as long as they spell my name right, kind of thing. It's,
yeah.
That's their attitude, I'm sure. I also thought Michael Lind's article was also a pretty good example of just how poorly these attacks are made.
Yes, I agree with you.
You know, and again, you're, I mean, this isn't a, the Sandel book, that was an honest attempt, and I give him credit for writing a fair review or critique of libertarianism. But that was a book. That was a book written by Harvard professor. Michael Lind is writing a blog post on Salon. Yeah. The standard is completely different. You know, you're not going to get a reasoned, treatise with footnotes and everything from Michael Lind or Ann Coulter.
But
it's just not the way they do.
This is one of the things that bothers me, because when you're going about that, especially for one of those large publications like Salon, Rolling Stone, or mm-hmm. Ann Coulter writing for National Review, perhaps, or Human Events Online, you're going to have thousands of immediate readers, mm-hmm. probably more than someone who would sell that book. Mm-hmm. Or in the short term, maybe the long term, through colleges or whatever. But so to me, if you're going to offer that punch, you want to make that punch as useful as possible. So you mm-hmm. want to provide as much, and this is what you do. Oh, we're coming back. We'll be right in. We continue at Liberty Conspiracy Radio. You can find our website at libertyconspiracy.com. I'm Gardner Goldsmith. I founded the Liberty Conspiracy a number of years ago and been very grateful to have connected with so many people in the so-called Freedom Liberty Movement. You can find our podcast at Podomatic and at iTunes. Just look us up under Liberty Conspiracy. I should have offered the name of the podcast to you when you want to look it up. And there are a number of other things that I can promote and so on, but I want to go right back to our guest as the music comes up. Stephen Smith's talking to us. Stephen Smith is located on the West Coast right now. We're on the East Coast. He's on the West Coast. I'm LG Grande, and he is Stephen Smith, the man who was behind a blog site which is no longer extant called A Beginner's Guide to Freedom.com, and just an amazing writer in favor of freedom. Stephen, we were talking a little bit about libertarianism being attacked at the beginning of the program, and how it seems to be resonating with a number of people, and it seems like the pop media is really starting to go after libertarians or libertarian concepts, everything from nullification to free markets to decentralization and things like that. And you offered to me in an email a great example, which was this attack on nullification that I played very early on. And let's just give people some examples of how we're sort of bringing it full circle now, how an idea which is clearly constitutional is being portrayed as racist and somehow detrimental to the great growth of America. And see if we can just refute this just very quickly. I just wanted to bring up, folks, if you get an opportunity, and Stephen, if you want to contribute, feel free. We talked about the so-called Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And at the time, there were many folks in many states that were pushing to not comply with that based on the concept of nullification. And Tom Woods has a great piece about the idea that nullification was something that was understood, and it wasn't just racist slave owners that wanted to separate from the North and nullify the Northern laws, and that this is something that goes back to the very concept of the Constitution itself. And I will read some of these things later at the end of the podcast. I will add some of this. But would you like to add any more thoughts on this nullification thing and how I think it's a real positive move?
Yeah, and I think certainly Tom Woods has done more than I think anybody on the concept of nullification. But the Rachel Maddow piece, again, is an example of the sort of guilt by association, sort of drive-by hit pieces that that we see against anything smattering of libertarianism or limited government. Mm. The whole piece that she did was the Confederacy, they talked about nullification. John C. Calhoun, he was a pro-slavery guy. He talked about nullification. So ipso facto, anybody who talks about nullification today must want to bring back slavery.
Right.
I mean,
that's
kind of the impression that they want to provide. They don't want to get into the merits of nullification. They don't want to get into the historical record. They don't want to get back into the founding documents to see, okay, well, what did people the founding fathers feel about it? Thomas Jefferson, you know, of course, he was another slaveholder. So what does it matter what he?
Alexander Hamilton,
Hamilton, John Madison, any of those guys. And you know, I think Tom Woods makes a point. It's like, let's look at how nullification was actually used, and it was used by Northern abolitionists to suggest that they didn't have to follow the Fugitive Slave Law, which would have required them, to return runaway slaves to their quote unquote owners in the South, or in the slaveholding, I should say, the slaveholding states.
Absolutely.
So. Nullification was also used to oppose the draft and conscription of children. It was used to oppose constraints on free trade. Today, functionally, Colorado and Washington have used nullification to legalize marijuana.
Absolutely.
They are, and which is typically a position that the left is generally amenable to. So again, it's not a very, very, a very good argument when you get down to it, but it's probably enough for prime time.
Well, I think it's terrific that you cover it the way that you have done, and just in these past few minutes. And at the end of the podcast, folks, I'll read to you some of the things that to which Stephen refers, and some of that historical information. Stephen, you mentioned at the beginning of the program, you've mentioned this a number of times, that it seems like there, and I brought it up at the very opening, it seems like there really are a lot more articles that are popping up that are from pop media outlets that are very critical of libertarianism. And you spotted one, and actually a particular author who seems to be the go-to person. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, well, this would be Michael Lind on Salon.com. He seems to be the guy they trot out every time they want a hit piece on libertarianism written, and they know that they'll get a lot of hits because of it, because the liberty blogosphere is going to light up, and write their their responses to it in posts, and that's just going to drive more traffic to Salon, which is all they care about as far as I'm concerned. But Michael Lind, he's a big government guy. He's a professor at the University of Texas, a law professor. He's worked for the State Department. So he's one of these professional statists. But a couple months ago, there have been many people who wrote about this, a couple months ago he wrote a piece called "The Question Libertarians Just Can't Answer." And he opens it up. He goes, "Why are there no libertarian countries?" So you know, one sentence in, and Lind is already muddying the water. What does he mean by the term libertarian countries? Is he referring to libertarianism as a specific type of political organization in the same way that we use the terms monarchy or constitutional republic or communist dictatorship? You know, if so, then what degree of libertarianism would satisfy Lind's unspecified criteria and qualify as a libertarian country? Would it be Nozick's night watchman state? Would it be Hayek's limited government model with a minimal social safety net? Or would only full-on Rothbardian anarcho-capitalism suffice? You know, maybe he has an idea in mind.
But he hasn't defined it.
He hasn't defined it.
Right.
He could just mean a generalized attitude of, you know, socially tolerant and fiscally restrained.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? You know, you couldn't tell. Whatever he means, he doesn't explain it in his article.
Right, definitely not.
But he keeps going on. He goes, if libertarians are correct in claiming that they understand how best to organize a modern society, how is it that not a single country in the world in the early 21st century is organized along libertarian lines? Now, I think anybody listening here would recognize that immediately as a straw man argument. Libertarians do not claim they understand how best to organize a modern society. That's kind of our point, as a matter of fact. We only claim that it is wrong to initiate violence against others. Only statists like Michael Lind claim that they know how to organize society.
Yeah.
And they're so convinced that they're right that they're willing to throw you in jail if you refuse to go along with their grand scheme. So the article goes on and on. It's more of the same thing. One of the things that I found in the article was that he kind of moves the goalposts a lot. so in one paragraph, he says, you know, if you ask libertarians to point to a libertarian country, we might say Chile with private social security, or Sweden, even though it has a kind of a big government safety net, does have vouchers for schools. But this isn't an adequate response. Libertarian theorists have the luxury of mixing and matching policies to create an imaginary utopia. A real company must function simultaneously in different realms: defense and the economy, law enforcement and some kind of system to support the poor. Being able to point to one truly libertarian country would provide at least some evidence that libertarianism can work in the real world. So you kind of, now he's starting to get some sense of what he means by libertarian countries. And And I think what he really is trying to say is libertarian-influenced governments. Hong Kong might be an example of free trade. Portugal might be an example of the successful decriminalization of drugs, what have you. But merely supporting some mix of market-oriented and socially tolerant programs is not adequate for Lind. Mm. Evidently, it's a pass-fail class, and a single country must be purely libertarian in order to get any credit whatsoever. But then he goes right into this next paragraph. He goes, some political philosophies pass this test. For much of the global center left, the ideal for several generations has been Nordic social democracy, what the late liberal economist Robert Heilbronner described as a slightly idealized Sweden. Other political philosophies pass the test, even if their exemplars flunk other tests.
Hold on, Stephen. Tell you what, we're coming up to the end of the radio show, but let's continue this for the podcast audience, and we'll put this out for the podcast audience, all right?
Sounds good.
All right, great, great. So, folks, listen on the radio. You're just going to have to check the podcast. Thanks for listening. Okay, I'm going to disconnect from the network, and thank you for staying with me during these breaks and so on, Stephen. It's
my pleasure, no problem.
I appreciate it very much. Let's see. Boy, this video that's Schiff made in front of Walmart.
Yeah,
I just saw this thing for the first time tonight, and I don't know if you've ever seen this thing before, but it is brilliant.
I know. I haven't watched it all the way through, but I know what you're talking about.
Oh man, it's just great. It's just so. I just got such pleasure watching him walk next to these people, and as they would stand there and they would say, "Oh yeah, I'm definitely in favor of higher wages for the employees," and like, "Oh great, so you're going to pay more now." And they're like, "What?" And then they start to walk away. He's like, "Well, you want to give them higher wages, so that was going to cost the company more, so you're going to pay more. So why don't you give me the money now?" And it's like, and he has a calculator. It's just hilarious. Okay, so please continue with your piece. For the podcast audience, folks, Stephen Smith continues with us as he addresses some of the arguments that have been posed by Salon.com's go-to guy and now resident anti-libertarian guy. Michael Lind, L-I-N-D.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So as we were saying, you know, some political philosophies pass this test. For much of the global center left, the ideal for several generations has been Nordic social democracy, what the late liberal economist Robert Heilbronner described as a slightly idealized Sweden. Other political philosophies pass the test, even if their exemplars flunk other tests. Until a few decades ago, supporters of communism in the West could point to the Soviet Union and other Marxist-Leninist dictatorships as example of really existing socialism. They argued that while communist regimes fell short in the areas of democracy and civil rights, they proved that socialism can succeed in a large-scale modern industrial society. Okay. So, you note how the standard set forth earlier for libertarian countries is not the same standard to which the socialist countries are held.
Absolutely right.
Whereas privatized social security and school choice is not enough to qualify a country's libertarian because they fall short of the most extreme form of libertarianism. Countries that fall short of the most extreme form of socialism, i.e. communism, still qualify as examples of socialism.
Yes.
So Sweden gets socialist credit for its large welfare state, but no libertarian credit for its relatively free market and school choice. And at no point does he give market forces, which would presumably factor somewhere on the libertarian side of the equation, any credit at all for raising standards of living or for producing the incredible wealth upon which those socialist governments around the world depend.
Right, right.
No, it wonders why governments around the world haven't fully embraced all the unspoken libertarian principles that are presumably rattling around somewhere in his head. one would think that that would be easy enough to figure out, right? I mean, it's not in the interest of the people in government to do so.
Yeah.
As the man said, government is the negation of liberty. There is no reason to believe that those in government, people who have worked tirelessly to expand their dominion over others and help themselves to the fruits of other people's labor, would suddenly shun the power to loot, kill, and control, even if doing so would result in greater material benefits for society as a whole. And there's no reason to believe that those who benefit from the status quo, think Monsanto, GM, the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, welfare recipients of both the corporate and industrial and individual varieties, etc., would be keen to do so either. So, as the other guy said, liberty means responsibility. That is why most men dread it.
So
this is, you know, this is what I call the Lind Luddite challenge. The implication is that anything that hasn't been tried yet must be inferior to the status quo. Now, if this were all that it took to defeat an idea, I'm sure the world would be a much different place today. I mean, just think 1775.
Right.
Michael Lind would be saying, hey, if a constitutional republic is so great, why hasn't any European country gotten rid of its monarchy? if we were 1907, he'd be saying, hey, if the Model T were so great, why have people always ridden horses? I mean, that's the kind of thought process.
Right.
So again, I don't think the quality of arguments against libertarianism is necessarily all that impressive, but the quantity is definitely increasing, at least from what I've seen anecdotally. So I take that as a compliment, to be honest, because it's clear that they're worried that these libertarian ideas are challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
And they're looking to try and get ahead of that before it takes root and people start questioning why we really need these idiots in the first place.
I love the way you describe it as the status quo. That's excellent. It's a beautiful thing. And I think you're absolutely right. There are more moves being made all the time, whether people are moving to Bitcoin for their transactions, whether it's people signing on to a YouTube channel that might have something like, you know, the Corbett Report, just one guy who's connecting with a lot of other people, whether it's folks who are going to the Mises Institute website, whether it's folks who are going to Lou Rockwell and so on. And I think that for those of us who are interested in pure freedom and taking that idea and seeing where it has been tested, where it has been tried, where other ideas have been tried that stand in opposition to it, and comparing those things. We're just looking for empirical information, you know, looking to be redundant. We're looking for information. And it seems that in the arguments that are being presented, they either don't offer their own information in a fair way on the same standard that they ask you to offer your information, or they're not interested in you offering your information at all, and they want to paint you in a certain way that you can't even enter the sphere to talk about it because they're not going to listen to what you're actually saying. They're going to replace it with something else, like a term, the Confederacy, slave states, hate children, hate old people, hate workers, keep them down, exploit, you know, these types of things. And to me, the measure of an honest person is a person who's willing to look at that terminology and say, is this applicable? What is the definition of this? What do you mean by this? Why are you trying to apply it here? Is it valid to do this? And I don't see them doing that in a fair way. And I think the more often they do that, sure, they're going to get some people who will latch on to the Rachel Maddow arguments and so on. But those are people who are generally going to be inclined to say, well, I'm not going to say all of them, but many of those people will be people who would already be against libertarian ideas in the first place. But hopefully the inquisitive minds might start to recognize that they're not being given a full deal of the cards when they're entering the game there, that the dealer, Rachel Maddow, is giving them not the full amount when they're going to play poker with her, and she's holding back a number of cards, so they can't actually play the game properly. So hopefully that is the sort of thing. I love to explore stuff like this, and that's why I admire people who write books or write blog articles and things that really do have some evidence and oomph to them. And of course, that's what you did with you know, Beginner's Guide. So, yeah. Anyway, any other thoughts, Stephen?
Thanks. No, you know, I think we will continue to see this. You know, I have, I consume media from both sides of the statist spectrum. I listen, you know, I listen to Rush, I listen to Hannity, but I watch MSNBC, and I do see that the attacks are increasing in frequency, but they are very cautious not to engage on any sort of philosophical level. They're very cautious not to discuss actual ideas. They just want to dismiss it out of hand. I think the right is just more, I think, more, it's just dismissive. I think, you know, I think the Ann Coulter quote was pretty telling. Eventually libertarians turn 19 and stop smoking pot. Ha ha.
Really,
and that,
really
and sad. That's it.
Yeah.
I think the ad hominem attacks are more common from the left, where it's, again, they're trying to do some sort of smear job. Again, guilt by association, trying to tie ideas to Confederacy and racism and things like that, so that they can marginalize the people, marginalize the messenger, without having to engage the message.
Yeah.
And it's something we're just going to have to deal with.
I think this is excellent. I can't wait to turn this into a podcast. And I thank you. I know that, you know, we spoke about certain things off the air and so on, and it's very difficult for me to say goodbye to you because I like you so much and you're such a good guy. And, you know, so having to, you know, sign off on a show like this, it's like, oh, gee, I'm going to say goodbye and everything. But you're an ace guy, not only as a person and a friend, but a great thinker who I think has touched a lot of people you've probably, you know, will never meet. And I think that is a truly remarkable thing. It's
thanks.
Yeah, it's
I appreciate
cool.
it.
Yeah,
no, thanks for giving me the opportunity. It's been too long. It's been good to talk to you.
You got it, man. I will close off. Why don't you say a farewell to our podcast audience in our traditional prisoner way, and I'll sit.
Be seeing you.
show.